whose parents were very sporty, the kids become very sporty.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that kind of, we put in, genetic link between them.
Yes.
So it's better both nature and nurture. You cannot say, you know, it's definitely this or it's definitely that. A human being is too intricate to kind of pinpoint it.
Yeah. But, well, what you were saying is that human beings are an amalgam of...
Exactly.
Of different things and different factors that are involved.
It's such a fascinating being.
Yes.
That you cannot just pinpoint it, you know, if it's Ashraful Makhlukat, the best of creation, you can't just say it definitely is this or it definitely is that.
But you know that in Islam there is always the emphasis on self-knowledge. So if you know yourself, then this facilitates your way, in fact, toward God, right? But so based on this or in line with this, I'll ask you this question again. How would you consider yourself, like a sociable person, a lonely person, or what?
Like correctly said, at times you just want to be left alone.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean you are lonely. There's a difference between being alone
and
being lonely.
Right.
And you can be alone.
Yes.
But you don't feel loneliness.
Exactly.
There's a difference between the two terms.
There is, yeah.
Right? There's people alone. Okay, for example, I just want to be alone.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean I don't want to, I feel lonely.
We always have this expression like you feel lonely, you know, well, even if you are in let's say, in a group of people.
Exactly. For example,
like you are not alone, but you feel lonely.
The best example is peer pressure. One of the examples that they give is the concept of peer pressure.
Right.
Or a kid who's bullied. A kid can be in a group of friends,
mm-hmm.
but he's bullied.
Right.
He feels alone and lonely in that particular group. But even though he's surrounded by people.
Right. Brother Ali Mohsen, you mentioned something before I entered the discussion with Brother Yasser about the negative side, psychologically speaking, that are, in fact, to being lonely. Would you elaborate on that?
Well, before I go to that, because you just asked the question from the Brother Yasser, was about man arafa nafsa, whoever knows about himself can better, obviously, he can reach towards the perfection or reach towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Well, this can be done in a society, in a social life. This can be done when a person is alone. There are different school of thoughts. Obviously, we have Sufism as well.
Mm-hmm.
They believe that you need to just get out of this world. You will sit on a side and you pray to God and then you reach to the perfection. On top of that, the school of Ahlul Bayt denies this concept and they say, no, you need to live within people. And by serving people, living in the people, experiencing what is happening in the society, you need to reach to perfection with these means. Obviously, as Brother Yasser also mentioned, that a person can be obviously be made his, we can say like this person can be made by living in the society. Obviously, the friends, parents, your relatives, neighbors, they all have effects on you. When we talk about loneliness, obviously, the negative points, before I talk about the negative points of this, we need to know about the reasons. What are the reasons, basically?
Mm-hmm.
It's basically the environment in which that child is grown makes him a lonely person or a social person.
Mm-hmm.
If the parents, or maybe if he was shy in his childhood and his parents kept him away from the society, they were not very much... you can say socializing between the people, among the people. So that causes this kid to, when he's raised up, he feels lonely and he's alone.
Yes.
And he prefers to work alone.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas there are some people who enjoy team working.
Yes.
So there are different people.
Yes.
And about the negative effects, obviously, if that is affecting psychologically and making him not growing mentally,
mm-hmm.
That is one of the negative effects that we can see. Whereas there were people who worked alone, who lived, who enjoyed their life. So it again depends on the situation, in which situation are you. And obviously loneliness is not preferred. Obviously you need some helper, some friend to share mm-hmm. your, you can say like things that you have that's going on. So that you free yourself from the things or thoughts that you have.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously there are cure as well for this.
Thank you very much, Brother Ali Mohsen and Brother Yasser, my dear guests in this program, Back to Reality on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, signing off.
Ya Allah, يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رازك
يا الله
يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رازك لتصي دليلتك once again.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Whose Streets, directed by Saba Folayan and Damon Davis. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Lee Jasper, who is a former policing director for London and social justice campaigner. He is also a Black Sox sponsor, which was formed in 2015 as a result of events concerning the increasing levels of violence impacting London's black communities. Now, Whose Streets is an unflinching look at the Ferguson uprising in the US state of Missouri. The uprising sparked nationwide protests the day after the fatal shooting of Michael Brown by white police officer Darren Wilson on August 9, 2014. Now, filmed on the front line of the clashes, this documentary captures the explosions, the tear gas, and the military-style police vehicles up close. And at the same time, the film also manages to show the anger and sense of outrage that the heavy-handed response provoked.
Anybody growing up here, you tangibly know when you cross the county line, you got to drive a little differently. Your behavior changes because you know how policing changes.
Ferguson police just killed a man in front of my apartment.
People flooded in the area have some experience with police.
Things have never been right for black folks in America.
We're trying to mourn, and you came here with 300 cop cars, right here in canine units.
You gonna shoot me too?
But that ain't the story that you hear about.
This movement was born in love.
We are raising activists. If there's going to be any change, it starts with our children.
This is going to be my fighter right here. Come here.
Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary provides a really great insight into the racial tensions of the black community in Ferguson and the police and the issue of police brutality is brought up. And we also get incredible access of the residents themselves who express their struggle from their point of view. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on Whose Streets?
The film is very specifically about Ferguson. It's not a general film about policing in America or Black Lives Matter or any of the bigger issues. It's very, very specifically about Ferguson. It does obviously touch on much bigger issues as a result. So it feels like a really important document, but it's not as easy to watch as a film. It doesn't have a central narrative line. It has a lot of great characters in it, people that it explores. But the thing that makes it really, really worth watching is the footage in it. It's full of incredibly shot footage on people's phones and their own private cameras right on the streets in the middle of all of these riots and all of the tensions and the back and forth of everything going on. So it's showing us a side of the story that the media never showed, because the media kind of took a very slanted view of this whole thing. And
the documentary highlights this.
The documentary contrasts the footage that was shot in the streets with what the media showed the public, and that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes the film definitely worth seeing.
So as Rich was saying, it is an incredibly big topic, lots of layers, especially on the issue of racism, police brutality, and American gun violence. and so forth. Luc, if I could turn to you now, what's your take on these sorts of films and why are they important?
I think it's an important part of documentation of the struggle of ordinary communities against excessive police violence and institutionalized racism. And that part, you know, it forms an essential documentary narrative around detailing their particular stories from a human perspective. Each individual family is looked at and goes into some detail. So it really gives you the full 3D picture of what a community under pressure from police racism and violence looks like, feels like, smells like, how they respond personally, how it affects their personal lives and the communities around them. And for that, I think it's an important part of social documentary.
But as Rich was saying, this documentary largely focuses on Ferguson. Mm. But as we know, the African American community have been plagued by police brutality for decades. But what is it that made the Ferguson uprising so different?
I think it's a combination of things, really. I think that by the time 2014 comes along and the impact on new technology, on people's understanding of justice and struggle, and the extent to which we now see people capturing inappropriate policing incidents on their own mobile phones, gives this a unique feel because it's from 1,001 different perspectives. If anything, this film is almost like a people's film made up of huge numbers of individual filmmakers who captured various scenes, and they've tried to knit it together in the way that has been described. So I think new technology, I think Hands Up, Don't Shoot, and the Black Lives Matter are all emanated from it. I think people were tired of an Obama rhetoric which was about equality but seemed very little in terms of holding police to be accountable at a local level. And the images themselves were so deeply resonant of the black experience and the African-American experience in the United States as to sort of re-excite an embryonic civil rights movement. The scenes we saw on black and white and color pictures of police brutality and victims in Ferguson in 2014 could have been Ferguson 1964. Yeah. And that was the power of their message.
And the power of relevance today, exactly. Yeah. Rich, so one observer in the documentary calls the clash between the police and the black community a, quote, unseen war. And it's been reported that $11 million was reportedly spent on law enforcement connected to the Ferguson uprising. Do you think the film is successful in showing how aggressive the policing is?
I think it really does. I mean, on the one side, it shows how these people just come to the streets just saying, how can you shoot an unarmed teenager 10 times? How can the police do this and then try to pretend like it's not an issue? And then the police respond to them coming out into the streets with, I mean, what you saw in the clip was, you know, they're all standing in a line looking really menacing. But later on, they come out with full riot gear and dogs and, you know, snipers on the tops of these giant tanks that are rolling into the streets. It's pretty terrifying because the police just reacted as if the public, who are just desperately crying out saying, don't treat us like this. The police are reacting as if they're the villains. The general public are the villains. And the film really captures that sense that these people just feel desperate and they don't really have a choice but to riot. They start off with a quiet vigil. It's a candlelight vigil. And their voices get louder and louder and louder because nobody's listening to them. And the police are responding like that.
As it said in the film also that Martin Luther King is quoted as saying the riots is the way, an act of showing the protest of the unheard. Now, Lee, what do you think of the militarization of the police? Is this an appropriate response to deal with the situation?
Well, it's not in a liberal democracy in supposedly, you know, the land of the free. I think what we're seeing all over the world, really, in Western democracies, is increasing militarization. And in fact, most Western police services are almost following a sort of Israeli policing model. That seems to be the standard model, to be very heavily militarized and to have the option of using overwhelming and overpowering force. The policing that we saw in Ferguson was akin to an invasion by a small army of a foreign occupying force seeking to invade another country. The combatants' language was the same, the imagery was the same, and I think it's a very dangerous precedent when the police force, and that's what it is, a force, can militarize itself using the advanced latest equipment available to them of any military in the world for use against civilians.
And it's exactly the point that you raised that, actually, because in the film we see an American Palestinian resident of Ferguson, and he used to live in the West Bank, and he said it's no different, the West Bank and Ferguson, in the way they're being treated. Do you think that's a fair point to make?
I think it is a fair point. I think if you look at the administration and dispensation of justice on the West Bank, Gaza, and you begin to look at Ferguson and other areas of the United States, you can see that an apartheid level of justice is being dispensed both in West Bank and in America. And to that extent, Israel and America share a similar approach to tackling minority groups that they dislike intensely, and that is to oppress and police them out of oblivion, really.
I want to talk quickly just how the police are portrayed in this documentary. We see the police officers wearing, some of them wearing bracelets for support for Darren Wilson, who shot Michael Brown. What did you make of this?
Well, I like the fact that they let them speak. It's not a purely one-sided documentary. It does kind of let people speak. But then the things the police said in reaction to this event and to the escalating violence were just all wrong. You know, they vilified Mike Brown. They showed, you know, a clip of him stealing something from a shop to say, oh, he was a hardened criminal. Well, it still doesn't mean that you can shoot him 10 times when he's unarmed in the back. I mean, that's crazy. The way that they spun the story and all of their press conferences and even the comments that they make to the cameras.
But they play the victim.
They play the victim. Themselves. And they act like they're the ones who are being attacked. And it's quite frightening, actually.
Sorry, Lee, you wanted to quickly add something?
I think what it also hints to is the vast chasm of perceptions between sections of white America and sections of black America about the nature, scale of racism. And what it means. And I think there's a conversation there that is being conducted through megaphones around a awfully complex and nuanced issue that is reflected in the total lack of understanding, I think, from white America about the reality of racism as it affects African Americans, Latinos, African Muslims, and so on and so forth in the USA. And
I don't think it's all of white America. I think there's a segment of white America that is just ignorant of the whole thing. There's quite a large segment that is aware of what's going on and is fighting.
I think I would agree with you, but I would say that racial inequality.
We did see a lot of white people in the crowds in support of the black.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and I think that's right. But I think that when you look at it over the course of history, that what you find is, despite whites having some theoretical acknowledgement of the existence of racism, racial inequality in America and the UK has gotten worse over every single measure. And so a rhetorical understanding of racism and a practical and a theoretical understanding that gives you the tools to deal with it are two separate things.
Okay, great points there. We'll continue this, just taking a break now.
This was actually the first camera that I got when I first started cop watching. I just put my stickers on it, you know, put a picture on my camera so when the police looking, they could see that cop watch stick on there. Got some walkie-talkies. This is two of them for me. So when I leave, I get one to my wife. So the cops don't come in Canfield, like, no more, like, doing none of that crap. They do stranger stuff. And that's because we done changed. We made them change what they doing. That's all I want. You know, don't give them an opportunity to gun somebody down in the street. Be out there to watch them. I don't go out with no weapons or nothing like that. I go out with my camera. That's my weapon, you know. And the fact is that since the police are not being held accountable, we have to hold them accountable.
So David there with the Cop Watch Initiative. It's quite an endearing and inspirational character. Rich, what did you make of his story and progression?
I enjoyed his story. I like the fact that he's taking a positive approach to it. He's doing something that's really important, and the footage he's capturing is invaluable in making sure that everyone understands what's really going on.
And Lee, what do you make of these sorts of initiatives? Do you think social media helps in the struggle for racial justice?
Incredibly. I think they've made a huge difference, actually, to the optics and the understanding of the reality of racism. And, of course, what we saw as a consequence of that type of activism is years later, you know, in-depth studies that showed the Ferguson police force were operating a sort of income-driven arrest policy that targeted poor blacks, and they were almost financially incentivized to racially profile that community. And I think that the cameras and the people and social media and access to it allows our community to get its voice heard.
And Rich, we also see, speaking of cameras actually, we see the coverage of how the hostility of the black community to the mainstream media in this documentary. Yeah. Why do you think they were so hostile as
portrayed? Well, because
the
mainstream media covered this as an incident of looting. You know, they didn't cover it as a policeman killed an unarmed teenager. They covered it as, you know, residents of Ferguson are looting their local shops. They covered the wrong story.
Leah, I just wanted to get your thoughts on this. What do you think of the mainstream media coverage of sort of these movements, Black Lives Matter and police brutality?
I think we saw the same at the Grenfell Tower fire disaster post there, where the mainstream media descended on a community and they were very hostile to them. And I think it's largely because there are so few black and ethnic minority peoples in British newsrooms and US newsrooms. And even where they are there, the narrative seems to be overwhelmingly one of a sort of establishment elite perspective. New technology and these films give us an absolute way of breaking through that moratorium of silence that we've had for so long and allows these fresh voices for justice to percolate into the public consciousness. So I think it's an incredibly exciting time, and the internet may well be the thing that holds policing to account to a greater extent than anything else we've ever done.
So that's there's hope in the battle ahead then. That's great. So we're just going to take
as long
a brief break now from a discussion.
Good evening. My name is Bernie Frazier, and like all of you all, I'm a Ferguson resident. There are a lot of people in Ferguson who have become very fearful of living in this community. But I would like to help you understand one thing. There are many people who have only been fearful for 2 months. There are more people who have been fearful for 2 decades.
Must have been very awkward for the black police officer to be in that situation, probably feeling very conflicted. I just want to read a statistic about US deaths by police gunfire, and by the Washington Post it reported that at least 1,000 people were killed in 2017, and it's on track to reach that level. Lee, why do you think the issue of police brutality is such a big problem in the US?
I think it's largely because of the failure of US justice system to deliver equitable justice for people who suffered from grievous police assault and brutality. There's been systematic cover-up of those sorts of abuses. We've seen that year after year. 1,000 people dying in 2017, those are the numbers you expect in a small war, somewhere very distant. And it shows the extent to which the process of Jim Crow policing, and that's what it is, it's a Jim Crow-style policing without all of the formality of policy and legislation, but producing equally iniquitous outcomes, is the reality for most black experiences in America. Two-tier justice, apartheid levels of administration of justice, and a gross denial of the reality of racism that just angers and inflames disadvantaged communities.
And in the documentary, we see various references to President Obama at the time, and we get the sense of the frustration that the residents were powerless, even with a black president, that they couldn't get their justice. What did you make of this?
Well, I mean, they say he's not a black president, which is very telling. It's a very telling thing for them to say, because they feel like he's not sticking up for them. I'm not sure how much power he has to intervene in a local clash like that. And he did initiate an investigation into it, which did result in the finding that that police force was systemically racist. Mm-hmm. But then every investigation into every police force in America has come up with that same in every city all over the entire country, from Los Angeles to you know, I mean, everywhere. Mm-hmm. So it's a problem in the entire nation. And I think you know, like you were saying, it's a nation that's never really dealt with slavery.
Absolutely.
They made it illegal 150 years ago, and then they never really got rid of it.
That's right.
And they've just changed it into a system of, you know, oppressive policing and marginalization and it's that system that's carried on, and people are just now saying we're not going to put up with this anymore.
And then fast forward to today's president, we have Donald Trump, who has been criticized for encouraging police brutality, saying that the police are being too nice. What do you think of Trump's role in race relations and police brutality?
Well, Trump is the original white Anglo-Saxon Protestant white privileged man in chief. He uses the bully boy pulpit in Charlottesville. He backed the fascists. He seemed completely unapologetic for the murder of an anti-fascist demonstrator by fascists in that area. He subsequently made his views known in relation to Muslims and African Americans. I mean, there can be no doubt. There are lots of people saying, oh, well, maybe Donald will mature with age or somehow become more nuanced by the politics of Washington. He's become more extreme, more discriminatory, and in fact encapsulates the very worst aspects of a sort of white supremacist, male, bigoted patriarchy that has somehow, through the dint of wealth and corruption, found its way to the top job in the United States. It's a disgrace for the country. It's a threat to the world. And it is emboldening and enlivening fascists and racists all over the world. So when Donald comes to the United Kingdom, I expect the whole of the European alt-right to turn out to counter any demonstrations we must put out. That's how dangerous this man is in the world.
I'm afraid we'll have to end on that powerful note, Lee. Thank you to both my guests and to you. Don't forget to leave your comments and your thoughts. I've been Camille Shambiati.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasser Rafi'i. Please stay tuned. The triangle of monotheism, ma'ad, and righteous deed is very important in Islamic teachings. Usually, these three concepts have been preached by the infallibles who themselves acted upon them. The followers of different prophets during history also believed in all these three important concepts. However, the prophets were themselves selected by Allah, and the last religion and prophet of Allah on earth was Islam and Prophet Muhammad. This shows the greatness of the concept of monotheism, ma'ad, and righteous deeds during the prophethood of different prophets of Allah. In other words, the main performer of these three concepts were the prophets and the infallible imams, and that's why obeying their orders regarding these three concepts were obliged. Allah is also very serious regarding these three concepts and has always ordered his prophets and imams to preach them for their people. Thank you very much, dear listeners of iRibe English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasser Rafi'i. To find out more about this program and our other programs, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care, and goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on a new episode of Muslim Lady. In the studio, of course, I have the honor of being with my friend, Sister Razia Shami. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam. How are you?
I'm very well. So we've been talking about modesty, haya, and its manifestation, which is chastity. We've explained that modesty is much more than just covering yourself and lowering your gaze. Modesty is a sense of integrity and self-respect.
A couple of days ago, I was doing a research on Surah Maryam.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually listening to a lecture by Mr. Qarati.
I love
his interpretation of the Quran, the way he approaches it.
So simple and concise.
So simple. Mm. And every time you look at it, he like something, a new aspect shines into your face. So I was like doing, looking at different verses, and I came across a really interesting topic. That it was written that there is a surah in the Noble Quran that is considered as the surah of Iffa. Which surah is that?
Surah Maryam?
No. Let me give you a hint. There are narrations that tell parents to teach their daughters and boys some things, and there are two different prescriptions for boys and girls. In the prescription of girls, it's been instructed to parents, especially fathers, because they're the one who are in charge of the spiritual upbringing of their children, to teach their daughters about this surah.
Surah An-Nur.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Subhanallah. So much valuable information. And it doesn't say that when you go to university, study it, or when you get married, study it. It says that teach it to your girls while they're still small. I mean, this is my understanding.
Right.
Because it's like the responsibility of a father, and once the girl gets married, it's no longer like his responsibility to teach.
So it's like before she gets married.
And the way it starts...
That's why I'm scared of it. It starts on such a serious, uncomfortable note. You know?
But, you know, it's filled with gems. And the thing is that the approach of the Noble Quran, CBT, cognitive behavioral treatment, in psychology, I'm not a psychologist. I haven't studied psychology, but I've done like some little researches here and there. And there in CBT, it says cognitive. First of all, work on the understanding of a person. If you want to change a person's behavior, try to change his mindset, his ideas, his ideology. Mm. This is exactly the methodology of the Quran. And in this beautiful surah An-Nur, it talks about the punishment of the fornicator and the fornicatress.
Yes.
If you're going to have a marriage, a believing man or woman should not marry an unbeliever or a fornicator or fornicatress.
Oh my God.
It divides. Mm. It takes sides that if you're a pious, chaste, modest person, your choices in marriage, you will have to be very careful about that.
Obviously.
And that group who commit adultery are not the right one for you. Mm. This is in chapter
Nur.
Or this is the concept of it. It all goes back to the concept of haya. Mm. It's the refruit of not practicing haya, but the roots or it stems from the topic or the issue of haya or modesty, right?
Yeah.
Or another topic that which talks about men lowering their eyes, lowering their gaze, women lowering their gaze. Again, this is in chapter Nur. Mm. Or the verse of hijab.
Subhanallah.
All of these, you know, that.
So that's why Amir al-Mu'mineen says teach them while they're still young.
Exactly.
You know? It's like the social. It's subhanallah, it's beautiful. Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam is saying teach your children from an early age how to socialize.
Exactly.
Through the Quran.
And one of the other gems that is in this surah, you know what it is? It's the verse that talks about marriage. Mm-hmm. That wankihul ayama minkum.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Marriage, 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 marriage. One of the pivotal points in a society is marriage.
Which actually in the 21st century is becoming so irrelevant. People are now, they're actually asking this question, is marriage still necessary in today's society?
Exactly.
Why must there be a contract? Why must there be
so much commitment?
Why must there be
so much money
a holy
spent?
Matrimony? Two people decide to live with each other, and they live with each other.
They don't want
to
continue.
They decide not to live with each other.
Goodbye.
Exactly.
If they're children, well, they can, you know, live with the mom or dad, and single parent, it's okay, you know. These people go on in the society. They have problem in their education, because these are researches that people who are kids who are brought up with only one parent, they have, especially kids who are with their moms and they don't have a father figure with them, later on in their education and in their, you know, schools, they their scores are lower, they have more problems.
Yeah.
And then a lot of them are driven to drug abuse, to violence, all of these, because this family formation, this constitution of family, which is the most beloved institution in the eyes of God, it hasn't been in the right place. So modesty has no meaning if there's no family.
Exactly. I think the problem with the society is that we've become so broken.
So fragmented.
So broken within ourselves, you know? So traumatized, so psychologically damaged, so irresponsible. I mean, one of my favorite speakers, when we're talking about confidence and turning your life around and being a better person, everyone's going to go, ooh, let's do that. But as soon as the topic of responsibility is mentioned, everyone gets uncomfortable. And they're like, oh, no, do we want to discuss that even? Because it feels like such a load, such a burden, such a chore. But I read once in a book, which gave me such a, it changed my perspective toward life altogether. He says, one day you wake up in the morning, you see a basket in front of your house, you remove the blanket, there's a baby inside it. What do? Do you just leave that baby there on your porch, go pick up your newspaper, walk in, make a coffee, and go about your day?
Definitely not.
Of course not. You are now responsible for that baby. That baby isn't your fault, but it's now your responsibility. Whether you want to adopt it and make it your own baby or take it to the closest police station or call a social worker, it is your responsibility. It's not your fault, though. You know, no one's going to blame you for that baby being on your porch or that baby not having parents. But it's now something that you have to take charge, you know? You have to take steps in order to fulfill that responsibility at this point. And I feel that as a society, we failed at claiming our responsibilities and showing up in our lives for moments that really called for it. And that's why applying Islamic values, which are actually based on our innate quality as humans, has become so hard, because we've mutated, you know? We've mutated away from how we're meant to be, and we're so broken, and we're so shattered, and we're so lost. It's so hard to make sense out of revelation now, and it's sad.
I think it's not so hard to make sense of revelation, because when you're still living in this world, it's so hard to make sense of this world.
My Lord, show me right from wrong. Give me light, make me strong. I know the road is long. Make me strong. Sometimes it just gets too much. I feel that I've lost touch. I know the road.
It has happened a lot for me in my personal life, in my private life. There are cases where I really cannot understand and cannot make the right choice if I take the right-hand choice, it's loss. If I take the left-hand choice, it's loss. I really don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. I'm like trapped.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I go to the Quran, like just to like do a research or to study it, to contemplate on some verses, I find so much serenity, so much depth.
MashaAllah.
Seriously, the words, they're full of light.
That's why Imam Sajjad said that if people in the East and people in the West perish, I wouldn't feel lonesome as long as I have the Quran.
Seriously.
I'd have somewhere to turn to.
It makes total sense. And the reason we have lost sense in life is because we have lost our track in life. Mm,
exactly.
We've been talking about haya and modesty, of course, from a Quranic and Hadithi perspective. Zainab, I wanted to bring into our audience's attention one specific categorization that we have for haya. And because so far we've been talking about haya in like your outer appearance, in the way you talk, in the way you eat, in the way you interact with other people. But I'm going to look at haya from another perspective.
Sure.
I think we can see haya in terms of whom is seeing us, right?
Right.
Because oftentimes we are ashamed or embarrassed to do something in front of, like, what when I say I'm ashamed or embarrassed, the first thing that comes to your mind is anyone watching. Looking?
Yeah.
Is there a camera?
Exactly.
See, so we are so sensitive and self-conscious with regards to other people judging us. And we want to preserve, you know, we've built a shield around ourselves. We put a beautiful mask on our faces, which is not necessarily the same as who we are inside. And we are so worried of if this mask is going to be a little bit tipped away from our face and people would actually see who is this weak person underneath this beautiful, you know.
Facade, yeah.
So the thing is that this is the first kind of haya, which is in the first level, that we are afraid, we are ashamed or embarrassed of other people watching us or knowing our faults. But if you're a little more concerned, if you're a deeper person, you would care about if, you know, the angels are looking at you. You're being watched. And in the Islamic perspective, based on the verses of the Noble Quran that we're going to mention them later on, I'm just going to say the category. So the second one is the angels. The third one is?
The imam.
Imam? Well, they fall into the category of, you know, angels.
Oh, okay. And what is it then?
God. For many people, they don't care that God is watching them. They say, you know, he's my friend. Or like, it's okay, you know.
Right.
I don't care.
Okay.
So people, they hide things from people. Second, at a higher level, the angels.
The angels.
Three, God. And the fourth one, which is the deepest level of haya, is, we've talked about it before, yourself.
Mm.
You come to the realization. You know, it's exactly the same approach as that beautiful narration that says people are after heaven because of different reasons. One who just likes to enjoy the blessings. One who doesn't like to be chastised. One who looks at it like the view of a merchant.
Mm.
The view of, do you remember that hadith? I think it was from Imam
the
Ali
view of a slave, the view of a merchant, and the finally it was the view of a free man.
Yeah, which you really, really want that satisfaction, this radiyat and mardiyat, this that you want to be well pleased with God and God well pleased with you, right? So at the fourth stage, you have truly understood and realized your true gem, and
I'm worth that more than this.
Exactly. And you don't want to shatter that kind of understanding or perception or reality that is within you, right? So looking at it one by one, I just want to share with you a beautiful hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam that says, "Ahsanul haya istihya'uka min nafsik," which means that the best kind of modesty is the modesty that you have with regards to yourself. Or another beautiful narration from Imam Ali alayhi salam that says, "Haya al-rajul min nafsihi thamarat al-iman," the fruit of believing in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the modesty of a person with regards to oneself.
Right.
So this iman, this belief system, the deeper it is, the more you know your worth, the more you know who you are, where you have come from, and where you're heading to, the better, the more clear your value system, and the better your modesty. Because all of these are somehow related.
There's obviously so much more that we need to talk about regarding the concept of haya, but that's all the time we have for today's episode of Muslim Lady. Thank you so very much for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
The British military complex is a shadow of its former empirical past, plagued by huge budget deficits, deteriorating equipment, and a very demoralized group of staff. Therefore, in order to bolster the bank balance, the British have leaned on their experience in the service sector and have turned their military into a training facilitator for paying customers. Following a Freedom of Information request by an anti-arms sales group, it's become apparent that the UK military has recently been responsible for training foreign military forces from over 150 countries around the world, equating to some two-thirds of the global countries, and has included tasks from battle training to military band practice. Whereas this could be seen as a sensible way of making money, the reality is that some 15 of the countries who have paid for the training have been rebuked by the British authorities for violations of human rights abuses, raising the question as to just how serious the British are when it comes to human rights and why they would agree to train such countries.
This is a difficult situation, and the opposition parties in Parliament have raised the question. The campaigning organisation at the centre of the current story, the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, has tried through the courts to bring into force a more coherent British ethical foreign policy. But that has not happened so far, and the Ministry of Defence considers that its relationships, particularly with certain Gulf monarchies, is very strong and important for Britain, and therefore it is basically giving them a green card to go ahead with do what they want.
Media spokesman for the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, Andrew Smith, was quoted as saying that the Act raises a very serious question for the British government, asking why they are so readily willing to support countries that apply repressive laws and have been accused of torture or have a known history of human rights violations. Yet the British government and military complex downplayed the allegations stating that such cooperation was merely part of the statecraft designed to improve international diplomatic relations, claiming that all decisions are made on a country-by-country basis. Yet with the UK on its knees financially from the impact of Brexit and the COVID-19 pandemic, it seems that when it comes to income, one can turn a blind eye to certain events, as every little helps when it comes to earning money. When the former British Prime Minister Theresa May travelled to the Persian Gulf to meet the leaders of Bahrain, the sole intention of the visit was to represent and sell British-made weapons to the island, and is something that's emulated today with other such nations in the West Asia region. With Saudi Arabia also a loyal customer of Britain when it comes to the arms trade, it seems that money flowing in from the arms trade to Britain is enough to divert attention away from the repressive regimes that they sell to. In fact, the Saudi-led war on Yemen is a prime example of such oppression, with Saudi bombs killing over 100,000 people in the country, making up nearly half of the 233,000 people who have lost their lives as a direct or indirect result of the war on Yemen. With the supply of arms knowingly being sold to the Saudis to perform such actions, are then the British not an accomplice to the crimes being committed by Riyadh? And if so, should the UK not be sanctioned for their role in the deaths of so many innocent civilians?
Well, certainly there's been concern expressed about British training for sniper forces in Bahrain, given the efforts of Bahrain Defence Force against the Shia majority population in certain situations. And then, of course, British support through the arms trade for the Saudi-led coalition's efforts in the war in Yemen since 2015. So this is something which is certainly full of contradictions. And again, the opposition parties in Parliament have raised these questions, would like to see the policies changed. But at the moment, there is no chance of that happening so long as Boris Johnson and his Conservative ministers are in power.
Yet the truth of the matter is that Britain itself is guilty of human rights abuses and has been demonstrated throughout time, with atrocious allegations being made against British soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan, and of course a lot closer to home in the treatment of the people of the north of Ireland during the Troubles, which saw British soldiers committing acts that will long remain in the memories of the victims, hence proving that Britain has no moral values when it comes to certain issues.
The coronavirus pandemic, which resulted in prolonged lockdowns and tough preventive measures, has had an adverse effect on the global economy. Like any other crisis, countries responded differently to the COVID-19 outbreak, which determined the extent of their success in tackling the ill effects of the disease. Take China, for example, the world's second largest economy. It was bound to overtake the United States as the biggest economy in 2030. But according to economists, the Asian country is expected to pass the U.S. 2 years earlier, as its gross domestic product is forecast to expand by more than 8% this year alone.
I would think that the Chinese economy would overtake the U.S. economy before then, very shortly, because the Chinese government, under the leadership of President Xi Jinping, they're proceeding with a completely different economic political orientation. They see development of infrastructure and industry as primary. And of course, they've uplifted, removed from poverty, almost 800 million people, which is close to three times the size of the United States.
Moreover, China is the only major economy to have avoided contraction in 2020. This was despite an ongoing economic war between Washington and Beijing. U.S. President Donald Trump levied massive tariffs on Chinese imports to offset Beijing's trade surplus with Washington. But experts argue that the U.S. lackluster handling of the coronavirus ironically gave China the economic advantage. That begs the question, what would be the upcoming U.S. administration's response to this reality? And how is Washington going to adjust its policy toward its biggest competitor? Over the past 4 years, Donald Trump's America First policy took U.S. protectionism to a new level. Trump started trade wars with allies and foes alike, ripped up trade deals, and made attempts